Hello, welcome and thank you for joining us and listening to our podcast, The God Beyond the Bible. Our podcast is released weekly each Friday. The content of each episode is based on the questions and curiosities we all have about God and the Bible. Many of our topics are considered taboo in the minds of the mainstream church. You will find our discussions to be, I think, refreshing and often far from traditional. But we don't just skirt around these complex issues, but confront them head on, and not in the way you're used to hearing them discussed on typical Christian talk shows. I'm Alan Rowland, creator and host of The God Beyond the Bible. As of the launch of this podcast, I've been a pastor for more than 35 years. My co-host is my daughter, Trayson, and our engineer co-producer is my daughter, Tabitha. Our mission is to encourage our audience, along with us, to open our minds to the reality that God is simply too big to be fully explored or experienced by the reading and studying of a single ancient work. In short, the Bible's not the sum of God, and to think this is to limit what He has done, is doing, and what He will do in our future. So with introductions made, thank you for listening, and let's dive into the topic of the day. Okay, and welcome to episode 4 of, and I'm going to have to stop counting these episodes because one of these days they'll get out of order if we have some up ahead, but this is, of course, podcast God Beyond the Bible by Seekers and For Seekers, and I'm Alan.
I'm Tabitha.
And I'm Trayson.
And so we're all present here today, and we're extending our topic from the last episode, and our topic, of course, is texts in the Bible referring to or quoting to or quoting texts outside our Bible today. And what's segment one going to be, Trayson?
Well, in the last episode, we discussed Old Testament passages that were quoted or referred to lost, forbidden, or unknown books. So today, we're going to talk about references and quotes in the New Testament from non-religious or pagan sources.
Okay. All right. And mainly last week we talked about what, the book of Jasher?
Yes.
And it was referred to at least two or three times in the book of Iddo the Seer. And I don't know why I have to laugh when I say that, but Iddo the Seer. But at least I'm not having to do Pliny.
Pliny the Elder.
Pliny the Elder's, what was it?
Pliny the Elder's Natural History.
Natural History. And I knew what I was trying to think of that was reminding me last week of being Irish. It was that Christmas song, Christmas time in Killarney.
It's Christmas in Killarney.
Or Christmas in Killarney, and that's, so I've been hearing that, and that's why I was laughing while I was doing. Okay, but let's get to the topic here. Talked about the book of Jasher and the book of Iddo the Seer, referred to both, I think, about three times in the Old Testament. In this episode, we'll move to the New Testament and take a look at references and quotes from the sources outside our known Bible today. I've read some sources who say there may be as many as 132 instances listed by Nestle's Greek New Testament. Don't know what that is. Does anybody know what that is?
I actually do. It is called...
Is it Nestle or Nestle's?
It's Nestle.
Oh, Nestle. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. I thought it was Nestle's and my mind went right straight to chocolate, so I didn't...
Well, they're actually spelled the same.
I thought so. Okay.
But it's actually called the Nestle Aland Edition. And it's named after its editors, Eberhard Nestle and Kurt Aland. And they actually carefully translated the biblical text back to its original Koine Greek. And it's the standard by which all Bibles are translated today. It's currently in its 28th edition, and it's now edited by the Institute for New Testament Textual Research.
Wowee. So, like I said, I read where... there may be as many as 132 instances in the New Testament where texts are referred to outside of our Bible or maybe even pagan or unreligious sources. I'm going to kick off here by talking about Paul referring to and quoting pagan authors. The first time that we look at it, we look at the first place we're going to look is 1 Corinthians 15:33. Paul's reminding the church at Corinth that bad company corrupts good manners or good character depending on which translation you read, and it's said to be a quote from Menander. Is that correct? Am I pronouncing
yes.
that about right? A Greek dramatist who lived from about 241 BC to 290 BC and who has written 108 comedies. I always kind of wonder, what's a Greek comedy? I know the Greek tragedy. Are they really funny? I mean, I'm not being silly. I'm just
No, I really don't know. I tried to look up a couple of his, but I couldn't find anything translated into English. But he is thought to have been a pupil of Theophrastus, who was Aristotle's successor.
Wowee. So Paul's quote, clearly, "Bad company corrupts good manners," is clearly a quote from Menander, taken from his work titled, and I don't know if it's Taeus, if the H is silent, it's T-H-A-I-S. So his work Taeus. I thought that was interesting that Paul would use a quote out of a Greek comedy to write to the folks at Corinth. Next on the quotes from pagan or other than religious sources is Titus 1:12 and 13. Paul writing to Titus in 1:12 says, "Even one of their own men, a prophet from Crete, has said about them," talking about the Cretans, I suppose, "the people of Crete are all liars, cruel animals, and lazy gluttons." So that's a quote from Epimenides of Gnosis. And I don't know, I think I'm doing that right. And he was what? What was he?
He was a Greek seer, a philosopher, and a poet from around the 7th century BC, but I actually found a really interesting history on him.
Okay.
He was probably the origin for the Rip Van Winkle story.
Okay. Really. Cool.
The claim is that he was tending his father's sheep, and he laid down and fell asleep in a cave and slept for 57 years. And he woke up with the gift of prophecy.
I like that. Okay.
And well, they also found out.
Now, this is Epimenides.
Yes.
Okay.
And they also found out after his death, when they took his cloak off, they found out he was covered head to toe in tattoos.
Oh.
I just thought it
from
was
from the 7th century, 800 years before Christ.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's pretty cool. Okay, we better keep moving, though, if we're going to get through this first segment. Thirdly, Paul again in Acts. Now, that's twice that Paul's used someone outside of religious source to quote. Thirdly, Paul again in Acts 17:28, "For in him we live, move, and exist, as some of your own poets have said, we are his offspring." And that was from Aretas, a Greek didactic poet who lived between 310 and 240 B.C. Anything on him, Jason?
Well, for one, didactic means educational.
Oh, thank
you. I had to look that word up.
Thank you.
Because I had no idea.
I was sounding really smart when I called him my dad. And you could tell by the way I pronounced it, I didn't have a clue what that was.
And he actually was from Tarsus. I just thought that was an interesting. They claim that he was
Wasn't Paul from Tarsus?
He was. So he could have been quoting a hometown guy.
Even though he lived a couple of hundred years before Paul came along. 200 or 300 years before Paul came along. Now, while Paul wasn't claiming his borrowed quotes to be divine or even divinely inspired, he was showing that he was a student of ancient writers, poets, prophets, and philosophers, which shows that he would have fit very well into this group here today, much like ourselves, who don't find it heresy to discover God beyond the Bible, or to read the writings of other seekers and consider at least some of their thoughts worth remembering and worth quoting. Now, I don't think this takes anything away from the power or the purpose of the New Testament itself. It merely shows that when we become believers or even inspired, it doesn't separate or remove us from our past that influences us, which makes Paul human. His likes, dislikes, beliefs, and experiences all show through in his writings and letters, just as these things all play a part in who we are today. Paul would even be apologetic at times if you've read much of his writing in the New Testament. He would write, "I really shouldn't be talking about these things, or I shouldn't be boasting like this, but nevertheless, I'll boast a little." And why did he write like that? It's because he was human. Was he called of God? Well, yes. Inspired? Absolutely. Inspiring on all levels. Was he fallible and human?
Yes.
Of course he was. Of course he was. So just another little thing to look at, because sometimes we want to make these folks like they were just superhuman or they weren't human at all. And they were really very human, and they had other interests outside of just the writing letters that are recorded in the Bible itself. So I'm getting the wrap-up signal. Time to wrap up segment one.
Welcome back to God Beyond the Bible, a podcast by seekers for seekers. I want to remind you, you can find us at godbeyondthebible.com, or you can search us on Facebook at God Beyond the Bible.
Today we're talking about lost and forbidden books, and this is our second episode in this series. Today we're talking about New Testament quotes and references to works that are outside the Bible that we have today. In the first segment, we covered Paul's quotes and references to non-religious sources, secular philosophers, poets, and prophets.
And of course, now in segment two, we're going to be talking about other New Testament references to lost, forbidden, or unknown sources. First and most apparent, of course, the Book of Enoch. We spoke of that some last episode. Referenced in Jude 1, 4, and 6, Jude chapter 1, verses 4 and 6, where he is alluding to some prophecy of destruction, and verse 14, where he actually identifies his source as the Book of Enoch. And it reads like this: Enoch, who lived in the seventh generation after Adam, prophesied about these people when he said, "Listen, the Lord is coming with countless thousands of his holy ones," then verse 15, "to execute judgment on the people of the world. He will convict every person of all the ungodly things they have done and for all the insults the ungodly sinners have spoken about him." So that was, we determined last time, that was a quote from Enoch
1:9.
Enoch 1:9. But then also in 2 Peter 2:4, and I thought this was interesting, where Peter writes of the fallen angels held prisoner in the pits until the day of judgment. And that was also from the Book of Enoch. I'd read that and I thought, now where did Peter grab this from? Because I would read that he said, you know, the spirits of those that are in chains waiting,
yes,
judgment. And that was also from
the Book of Enoch.
The Book of Enoch. Then again in 2 Peter 3:13, where he writes, "But we are looking forward to a new heaven and a new earth." And a lot of people always just attribute this to John over in the Book of Revelation, the new heaven and new earth. But I think that you had mentioned that Peter actually was before the Revelation. Peter wrote his,
yes,
epistle before the Revelation, right?
We actually think that John probably wrote the Book of Revelation between 70 and 80 AD. And Peter's thought to have been martyred in AD 65 or 67, so he would have actually already passed away before John sat down and wrote the Book of Revelation.
And this is a prophecy. Actually, this new heaven and new earth prophecy is prophesied by Enoch. And so that was interesting that's another Enoch quote,
it
I
was.
Guess. Some say John 7:38. That when Jesus referred to the scriptures declaring that rivers of living waters would flow forth from his heart is also a quote from Enoch. Now, I don't know. I haven't read enough of the Book of Enoch to know if that's really is one or not.
With the translation that I have, it's hard to say that it was a word for word quote, but I believe that it was.
Probably was. And it would be interesting to know that Jesus quoted from Enoch. So we have perhaps many scriptures indicating that Enoch was a viable and acceptable part of the early scriptures that was disallowed and even considered forbidden today. And we're going to talk about probably in the next episode that forbidden part of it. Where do we get that forbidden? Who makes it forbidden to read any of this? Well, some of the councils. Well, it wasn't just Nicaea. And I used to think that the Council of Nicaea had a big part in the, but they didn't. Actually, there were some councils before that, but we'll talk about that later. All right, let's jump over to 2 Timothy 3:8, where Paul names the opposers of Moses as Jannes and Jambres, and we talked about that last week a little bit, are said to be from the Book of Jasher. That's referred to in both 2 Samuel and Joshua as a known record of Israel. Some say that these names are also recorded in the Gospel of Nicodemus, and it's a book I'm really not familiar with, but Trayson, you are familiar with it.
I am. I actually sat down this past week, and I read the Book of Nicodemus.
Gospel of Nicodemus.
Yes, the Gospel of Nicodemus. It was actually called the Acts of Pilate.
That's right.
I read that. It chronicles the stories of Caiaphas and Pilate bringing Christ forth for trial. It claims the darkness on the day of the crucifixion was a solar eclipse, and that Caiaphas and Pilate later became believers. It also claims that Christ spent 3 days the 3 days between his death and resurrection in hell, which I thought was interesting because I've heard that said before, and I wondered if this is where...
Peter said that, didn't he?
Did he?
Didn't Peter write that? I think
I did not know that.
I think Peter wrote that he preached to the spirits.
Yes, and it actually says in the book of Nicodemus that he brought Adam out of hell and into heaven, wow, where he had been waiting. It's an interesting book, and it's absolutely worth a read.
Okay. In Paul's letter to 1 Corinthians, in 1 Corinthians 5:9, he speaks of a previous letter he wrote to the Corinthians advising them not to keep company with people who participate in sexual immorality. So many conclude, and I think I'm one of them, because I remember a long time ago discovering this, say, well, wait a minute, this is 1 Corinthians. How's he referring to a previous letter? So technically, we should have 1st, 2nd, and 3rd Corinthians in our New Testament, I think.
I think he lost a lot of... I mean, I think a lot of Paul's letters were lost through the years.
He told I skipped a part of it that talked about one of them in Colossians 4:16. Paul instructs the folks at Colossae to pass his letter to them that he had wrote to them onto the Laodiceans, and for them to read the letter that he had written to the Laodiceans, right? Mm-hmm. I forgot to mention that, didn't I? I think I jumped over that. So we have here a letter to a church that Paul says he wrote that we do not have included in the New Testament. Now, others said, no, it was really the book of Ephesians. It was a letter to the Ephesians, and the Laodiceans were hanging on to it. But I don't buy that. We work really hard, don't we, to try to just make everything just exactly perfect. I think Paul wrote a letter to the Laodiceans, and I think he wrote one to Colossians and intended for them to exchange letters.
I agree with that. I think things get lost in time. I mean, I can't keep things in my house from being misplaced in a year.
Yeah.
You can imagine in 2,000 years how many things can get lost.
And actually, we're going to talk about, maybe next time, we're going to talk about how we got our Bible, or how our Bible came, what it is right now. And there was actually one guy that was actually proponent. He was actually responsible for just hanging on to and gathering up most of Paul's letters and getting them in one place. Okay, we better keep moving. Matthew makes a reference in his gospel about in Matthew 2:23 that reads, "So the family went and lived in a town called Nazareth, and this fulfilled what the prophets had said, he will be called a Nazarene." And if you just a little real quick back reference on this, this is as Mary and Joseph and Jesus are coming back from Egypt, and they settled in Nazareth. I found that most reference Bibles either ignorantly or maybe deliberately use Judges 13:15 as a reference for this. And Judges 13:5 reads like this: "You will become pregnant and give birth to a son. You must not drink wine or eat any forbidden food, for your son will be dedicated to God as a Nazarite from the moment of his birth until the day of his death." Now, clearly and without question, this is a prophecy that Manoah and his wife received concerning their son, who?
Samson.
Right. It was a prophecy about Samson. And the word Nazarite, not Nazareth, is referring to a Levitical dedication vow to God whereby the person does not drink or cut his hair. And this has no reference to the geographical location of Nazareth at all. So Matthew obviously had some sort of ancient prophecy that we do not have today, which said Jesus shall be called a Nazarene. And of course, that closes out segment 2.
Welcome back to God Beyond the Bible, a podcast by seekers and for seekers. We would love to hear from you. If you have any comments or questions, you can contact us at email@godbeyondthebible.com, or of course, you can message us on Facebook.
In this episode, we're talking about lost and forbidden texts. This is episode 2, and we're talking about quotes and references in the New Testament that are not found in our Bible today. In this segment, we're talking about a quote from Jesus concerning a prophecy that we have no source for.
And of course, we're talking about Luke 24, verses 45 through 47. Now, Luke 24:45 reads like this: "Then he opened their minds to understand the scriptures." Verse 46. And he said, this is Jesus speaking, "Yes, it was written long ago that the Messiah would suffer and die and rise from the dead on the third day." Verse 47. "It was also written that this message would be proclaimed in the authority of his name to all the nations beginning in Jerusalem." Now, to me, this is extremely huge. Jesus is indicating here that there is a prophecy that included two important details concerning the Messiahship, just concerning him being Messiah, that he would suffer and die, and that he would be resurrected on the third day. Now, the two references that the reference Bibles use for this prophecy is Hosea 6:2, which reads, "In a short time he will restore us that we may live in his presence." King James reads like this, Hosea 6:1 and 2. "Come and let us return unto the Lord, for he has torn and he will heal us. He hath smitten and he will bind us up. After 2 days he will revive us. In the third day he will raise us up and we shall live in his sight." And then another reference is Daniel 9:24, which reads, "A period of 70 sets of 7 has been decreed for your people in your holy city to finish their rebellion, to put an end to their sin, to atone for their guilt, and to bring in everlasting righteousness, to confirm the prophetic vision, to anoint the most holy one." Now, I personally don't believe this was the vague prophecy that Jesus was referring to.
I get almost nothing out of that as a prophecy for Christ.
Well, and I know there's some vague messianic prophecies there that, yes, people say. I mean, it's kind of like, and her seed shall crush your head. You know, I mean, and I'm not disagreeing with that. I think that is a Christ
well.
Prophecy. But Jesus seemed to just be laying it right out here when he talked about this, that, hey, the prophecy says I'm going to be killed and I'm going to be raised on the third day. So one has to introduce great theological license to get either of these prophecies to predict the death and the third day resurrection of the Messiah, don't you think?
I can agree with that.
Others argue that Jesus was merely referring to a collection of other vague prophecies from Isaiah and the Psalms. Now, I'm not saying all prophecies are vague. I'm just saying that that's what others claim, that maybe vague is not the word I ought to be using. But,
well, it's layered.
Yeah.
When you read the Bible, especially, I just finished reading the book of Psalms recently, and I can, for the first time, see a lot of the prophecies that are in the Psalms, just
right,
reading one after another. But they're layered among other things. And that's something we forget about the Bible, is that there is layer after layer of meaning.
Absolutely. Such as Isaiah and the Psalms, combining them together to make this more direct prophecy. In other words, some claim, well, Jesus was taking a little bit here and a little bit there, and he was just putting it all together and making a quote. Or that his quote was more of a compilation of numerous prophecies. Now, a debate's not what our mission is here. I'd like to introduce the idea that maybe, just maybe, there was a direct prophecy that included the death and resurrection of Jesus in a clear and concise way, and for one reason or another, we don't have access to it. We know that the wise men, or the Magi, were not Jewish and had access to some very detailed information that led them on their journey to seek the Messiah, the Christ child. Anything about that?
I have searched, and there's really very little information out there. I did find some interesting. Have you ever read or heard of the Book of Wisdom of Solomon?
Yes, yes, I have.
If you've sat down and read it, it actually has some very interesting prophecy concerning Christ.
Oh, I didn't know that. I just thought it was more like the Book of Proverbs and just sort of...
The first two chapters of the Book of Wisdom and going on into the third chapter have very clear references to Christ.
Wow, I didn't know that. But talking about like the information that the Magi had, I'm thinking, you know, where did they get their information? Where did they figure this out? And the Jews couldn't figure it out, and they had it figured out?
And it had to have been very detailed for them to have the clarity of, this is the sign that we have been looking for.
Right. If it existed, this clear prophecy, we're still back to Jesus talking about the prophecy about he would suffer and die and on the third day be resurrected. If this prophecy existed, the Jews would certainly not want to produce it, for after all, they would be admitting that they rebelliously rejected the long-awaited Messiah in spite of some clear prophecy that pointed to Jesus as being the Christ and how he would die and be resurrected. I think perhaps in man's desperation, he feels he must somehow prove the Bible perfect and complete, rather than to consider that we may not have everything that's been written pertaining to God. Thus we strain, we stretch, we scramble and scratch to make some prophecy say something that they may really not say at all. Do you have anyone have anything to say before I get to the conclusion of this?
I think I absolutely agree with that. And I think if someone listening is not familiar with the Apocrypha or the lost books of the Bible, it's worth your time to sit down and read and see what's out there. We all have a discerning spirit.
Absolutely. We've got to keep that in mind. The Holy Spirit is the discerner of everything.
Yes.
And I've read some things that, I've discovered some things that I thought, wow, that really agrees with some things I understand.
It does.
So, in conclusion, is it possible that in our zeal to defend our faith that we've painted ourselves into the proverbial corner by trying to make claims about the Bible that the Bible does not make of itself? We must be careful not to make a single ancient work the sum of God, or we're in danger of that single work becoming God. And in that endeavor, we're bound to disallow anything that God may have done before or during the time span it covers. And most damaging of all, prohibiting God from speaking to us and working in us and through us in our present day and in the future. I've discovered that God's not stranded somewhere in the past, beckoning me to return back to another time, but that He's alive and well, able to speak and lead all who will ask and seek and knock today and tomorrow. I don't think God is looking down at His creation and saying, I sure never thought they would turn out like this, or I never expected that to happen. I believe for those who seek to know Him and not to be satisfied simply to know about Him, He's still very much as active in the affairs of His creation as He has ever been. He's still speaking, leading, inspiring in the Bible and beyond. Our God-in-the-box theology must be challenged, for after all, if the Bible is the sum of God, where's there opportunity for Him to be personal and real to us in our daily lives? If through the Bible is the only way we know Him, it's not only limiting Him, but experiencing Him only through the experience of others. What of Jesus' words to the Samaritan woman at the well, that the time will come, now has come, that those who worship God will not go to this mountain or that mountain or this temple or that temple, but will worship Him in spirit and in truth, for the Father desires those who worship Him to worship Him in this manner. So till next time, on God Beyond the Bible, God's grace and peace be on you, my fellow seekers.
Did you enjoy listening to God Beyond the Bible? Do you have an idea for an episode? Connect with us today. Visit our website at godbeyondthebible.com, all one word, or send us an email at email@godbeyondthebible.com, or you can visit us on Facebook. Just type God Beyond the Bible into the search bar.